You've landed on The Substance, a podcast aimed at being biblical, thoughtful, and human. Join us here every other week as we engage the culture without the culture war. I'm your host, Philip Marinello, and it's so great. We've been on a great run lately. I've been getting to talk to folks whose work I've enjoyed for a very long time, and actually, looking forward, that's going to continue with some of the guests we have coming down the pipeline here. But this was so fun, because we have circled this before. Back when we had Ned Bustard on to talk about St. Valentine and his work, we talked comics, we talked a little bit with Stephanie Stalvey as well, but this week is not only the first time we have on a full-time comics professional on the podcast, we've got Eisner-winning, Coretta Scott King Award-winning, and the very first cartoonist to win a National Book Award. We've got Nate Powell on the show with us. Most people, if you're not a comic book reader, you'll probably know him from his work with Senator John Lewis on the March trilogy. Phenomenal books. Lots of schools use these in their curriculum. I was actually in a school recently talking about podcasting with some of their students who are getting ready to start up a broadcasting department and start a school-wide podcast. And I saw that several of Nate Powell's books were in there, especially the March trilogy. This was a wonderful conversation. If you're new to The Substance, we are a variety show format where every other week we invite somebody who is talented, interesting, engaging in important or valuable work in their communities, and we talk to them about their work or a particular topic. Previous folks include Josh Nadeau from the Sword and Pencil account on Instagram, previously mentioned artist Stephanie Stalvey, Film Spotting's Josh Larson, and award-winning illustrator Rommel Ruiz. This week, like I said, we have on Nate Powell. We talk about art, justice, punk rock, all sorts of stuff. This was a wide-ranging conversation, and it was a blast. Nate has written several books, and he's got two new ones out. One just came out. That is Fall Through from Abrams. And later on this year, we've got his graphic adaptation of Lies My Teacher Told Me. I'm extremely excited about that. And I've got Fall Through waiting for me at the library, and I need to go pick it up. But yeah, this was extremely engaging, extremely enjoyable. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Nate Powell. I'll say off the top, Nate, thanks for your time. I really appreciate this. So here at The Substance, we really are trying to get at things just like the name. We try to be broad. People go broad sometimes and it can hurt them, but we are very interested in things of substance, things that are that really matter. And you are an artist that I was telling you before we recorded, I first saw your work, I believe, and that was when I was reading that monthly in Jeff Lemire's Sweet Tooth. That's now like a big Netflix hit as well. They've released it 100 times. I just saw the compendium at my shop with the whole thing. You came up with some of those top shelf guys, right?
Yes. So
Jeff and Matt and some of those other guys?
Yeah. Basically, I started submitting stuff to Top Shelf around the year 2000, and it took a couple of years and a couple of rejections, but we developed like a relationship through the mail at like Pen Pal
Critique. Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And basically, I started publishing with them in like just after in the year or two after Blankets came out. So yeah.
Okay.
Jeffrey Brown, Jeff Lemire, Matt Kent.
Oh, yeah, because you, Matt Kent, and was it Emmy Lennox were the guests on that one arc?
That's right.
I reread all of Sweet Tooth before the show came out, and I still haven't watched the show. I told my wife, I was like, I'm mainly excited for Jeff, but I was like, if I don't watch this the first week it's out, I'm not going to watch it until like 2 or 3 years after the entire show wraps. And that's probably what I'm going to do.
Yeah, that's the pressure.
I tried.
With like so many TV options, is you're like, it's either now or it's in like 3 years.
Yeah. No, I know. I was like, I want to watch that. Like, if I don't watch it right now, it's going to be like 5 years from now. And I think the third and final season may have aired or is coming soon. I'm not sure.
I believe so. Yeah.
Things come out so quick. But anyway, I was reading Sweet Tooth Monthly. Jeff Lemire is still one of my top guys. I'd love to get him on the show sometime. Yeah, I read just about everything he does. And I see, oh, we got some new people on this. And so both you and Nate and Emmy to a degree, I just like started following the careers. And one of the things that was apparent to me immediately, the first thing I read was your second big book. We have a number of artists on the show as well. I'd love to briefly hear, what's it like for you to explode on the scene in the public eye in the period of 2 or 3 years? They're like, oh, wow, this guy's really like an upcoming star. But like in reality, you've been plugging away for quite some time. Like your first graphic novel, you were in a band and had a full-time job that probably took you quite a while to complete, I would imagine.
It's true. And it's important to remember, I guess, like in the same way that there's so much invisible work on the leading the leading edge of any long-term project. But when talking about like a creative career or path, yeah, like I published my first comic in 1992 and then self-published 10 years before getting some of those collected through other publishers. And then, yeah, Swallow Me Whole, my first full-length graphic novel.
Yeah, 2008.
I started writing it late 2001 from a dream and then started slowly drawing it in 2004. Never really had an expectation that other people would want to publish it or that people would read it or whatever. But it was just that it's always that sort of fundamental drive of like, this is a thing that I need to express. And it's just got to be done my way. And we're going to figure it out along the way. So in a lot of ways with Swallow Me Whole, I feel like I lucked out that I really had no expectations and was really trying to stay true to this weird, powerful vision. And I was like, wait, people are reading this? Oh, I made it for myself. So I never thought about other people getting something out of it in my young cartoonist mind, my self-absorbed mind. And I was like, oh, there are a whole bunch of like teenagers and young adults who are like really into this book. And that was sort of the first time I realized that I had a responsibility to think about the potential readership or scope or context by which people were getting any access to any of my work.
Well, that's kind of interesting too, right? Like you started scratching down ideas in 2001, start working in earnest in 2004, book comes out in 2008, is a huge hit in the comics world. You win the Eisner. And then they're like, what do you got next? And you're like, I just put 7 years into this one thing. What do you mean? What? Like, but then you're on the treadmill.
Yeah, it's a weird feeling because, I feel like in general, there's about, it's like a 6 or 7 year slow cooker situation for any book. And like, I'm pretty fast. And so I average about a book a
year. You are pretty fast.
Or every year and a half. But that means I'm not like tooting my horn. This is not a good thing. I'm always working on multiple books at once where things are at a different stage of development. And so for years, especially since finishing the March trilogy, I've tried a couple of different times to back away from that model. Like I feel like my creative life goal centers around just the peace and focus of having one book to do at a time. And it's just really hard to actually like reach escape velocity from just having to constantly grind on multiple ideas.
Well, and you're also a husband. You have two kids?
Two kids, yes.
Yeah, you're raising two kids in America trying to make it, creating comic books, which is both like, on one hand, like that's amazing that you get to do that. But then you're like, I would imagine the life of somebody who solely is living off of the creative work. You're like, man, I got to have a lot of irons in the fire. So Silence of Our Friends came out in 2012.
Yeah.
That was a book that I loved. I mean, I still do. Like that was very impactful. And I was like, oh, he just drew this. So one of the things you've always had from earlier on in your public career is you have like your solo projects where you come up with the idea, write it, draw it all yourself. And then you've also, I mean, March, that's probably going to be your legacy, right? Like you work very well with others. So you're not solely limited on only what you create. And I imagine that in some ways is helpful if you're like, okay, like you already have a pre-existing track to kind of run on when you're doing those books.
It's true. Yeah. It's helpful. It's healthy for me. It's also practical in terms of the fact that like, you know, my home planet is typically my weird magical realist fiction that's full of feelings. I'm best known for doing nonfiction, working with writers, doing nonfiction or historical work, even if it is fictional, like with Two Dead or Silence of Our Friends, both are in that same bucket. And those typically get me enough money to make a living. So a lot of it has been meticulously balancing years in advance how much time I can simultaneously put into a weird solo fiction graphic novel and a nonfiction work that might have a little bit bigger of an advance or something. And then basically over time, just developing a sense for how that's going to help me get by and pay the bills and actually be able to finish the projects.
Sure. So, I mean, thinking about the substance, like I love your like illustration style, but when I read Any Empire after that came out very quickly after I read your Sweet Tooth issue. So I picked it up and I read it. There's a couple of things I want to talk to you about that, but I was just very struck by how like visceral it was. And I probably wouldn't have used that specific word, but substantive. Like it was a very entertaining and engaging read. But like when you put it down, you're left to like think about like some very real things. And I mean, in some ways, the book was autobiographical, right?
Yeah, like as a story and as a book, it's certainly fiction. But by the numbers, probably 70% of the stuff in there is like a restructuring of my own childhood experiences as like a G.I. Joe kid in a military family in the Reagan era. I really didn't have a way to define what it was at the time. I would just call it like half fiction.
Sure.
But
yeah, I love the magical realism fiction. Like I like all sorts of genres, but I mean, I really, especially in comics, and we've talked about comics a few times on the show. A couple episodes ago, we actually had an illustrator. He does a lot of illustrative work, and he's like, yeah, comics were super formative for me. And like, it's, you can do whatever you want, like your imagination and your personality and your lived experience. That's why, I mean, today we're recording on a Wednesday. I was in my shop today, picked up a couple books, and it's like, there is always, for the right books, there's a lot of mass market stuff that is just a product, but there is a lot of really wonderful stuff in the comic space that is from the heart. And with Any Empire, you both have a very like an interesting coming of age story, but then if the reader wants, you can kind of probe questions of like a societal culture of like militarism. And that's not something that like I think about often with pop culture, even like you mentioned G.I. Joe. And that's actually a question I had. How did you receive it? Because in that era, like there was definitely social media. When Larry Hama wrote his little blurb, what in the world was that like for you?
Okay. So yeah. I believe that when my editor...
And Larry Hama, for the listeners, Larry Hama is the original creator of G.I. Joe.
Yeah, essentially. Like, you know, and we all know...
Yes, there are many. There are many.
Well, yeah, like, but you're correct. Like, G.I. Joe was relaunched in the early 80s as a toy line. And they basically made history in that crucial year where the law changed in terms of advertising content on TV for toys and stuff, and basically they're like we're gonna have a comic to go with this to help launch and promote,
help sell toys. Very toys. American.
Yeah. And so it was actually the first television, it was the first time comic books were ever promoted on television on an ad. But they got Larry Hama to write basically the entire like decades worth of G.I. Joe, hundreds of characters.
Incredible stories. Really. Like, I've not really read them in their entirety, but everything I read, you're just like, this is incredible comics.
Yeah, he really put his soul and his mind and his own experiences into it. So like, yeah, I was like 4 years old when G.I. Joe hit. But yeah, like once I got curious as a, you know, in my late 20s, digging back through old issues, I was like, I wonder how these hold up. And I was amazed that like the maybe first 30 to 40 issues, maybe all the way to 50, I was like, oh, I was like, there's a reason why this was the number one comic, like competing with X-Men at the time. And there's a reason why I was so drawn into it. And it's really an argument for like, you know, the compelling nature of getting solid creators to do their best.
Social fiction and teen books very much. Appealed to a lot of us and still do.
You bet.
But so yeah, like, what was that like when you saw that he read your book, and two, that he had such glowing things to say as some like, and this is something that we will absolutely get into, like American legacies in many realms are very complicated. And like, you can look at G.I. Joe and go, as a conscious person, go, some really great stuff. But then you're like, also, man, this probably like sold militarism like to generations of people. Like they're still making G.I. Joe cartoons and comics and movies. So like that's a legacy to grapple with too, which was part of what you were doing in your book.
You bet. I mean, it was unreal to get Larry Hama to read and absorb what I was trying to do. I didn't even really know it was possible at that time because I was barely like I had a, you know, like defunct MySpace account. But like at the time, I was so new to like full time comics and jumping in the comics pond and being less involved with punk as a lifelong subculture. So I didn't really know what a small pond comics were, even going all the way up to Marvel and DC creators and stuff. And to me, this is one of the most enduring and wonderful things about comics as a creative community and an industry is that it doesn't take long to realize that it is all one pond.
Oh yeah. It's not a big community.
Oh no, it's not. So yeah, that was surreal, but also like increasingly, like so much of any empire had to do with a lot of observations that I was having early on in this modern era, which I would pinpoint as starting around 2007. And a lot of it was being a Southerner, really settling in here in the lower Midwest, but starting to see different dimensions of racism, segregation, inequality here in the Midwest, and seeing ways in which my surroundings were not only more backwards than where I had lived in the South, but also I saw the future coming. Mm-hmm. Back in 2007, 2008, there was a very strong sense of this quietly amassing paramilitary, anti-democracy, fascist force. Like I live in a nominally progressive college town surrounded by white supremacists and armed paramilitary groups. That dynamic tension is America in microcosm.
Oh, yeah.
But it's important to recognize that like a lot of what went into any empire was trying with my at the time more limited storytelling skills in terms of clarity and concreteness, but really trying to cast an alarm from the past into our present day. And so it's very chilling when I reread Any Empire now, because I was attempting to draw a vision of the world we live in today as a warning.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was flipping through that earlier in preparing for this, and chilling is a perfect word. I mean, looking at stuff in March, and I definitely want to talk about Save It for Later, but going back and looking through Any Empire, like, it's chilling. Like, and that's one of the wonderful things. On the show, we cover movies a lot, and I love how like genre fiction can shine light on these things. Like we covered Night of the Living Dead and the original Godzilla. Like a lot, like you can go, oh, like these are fun stories, but they also really shed light on important things. And then with Any Empire, like you read that and you just look at the last couple weeks of headlines, or if it's possible in the age of being inundated by information the last several years, you're like, yeah, like this is the logical equivalent. A couple days ago, I was listening to one of your podcasts from like 2011, and wow, you were talking about like, oh man, this is crazy how like militarized and fascist and like religious extremists were having in 2011. And I was like, man, if only things were as radical as they were in 2011, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, it was really a head spinning experience. Once I started developing this now longstanding curiosity about national myth, you know, fascist and paramilitary authoritarian influence in pop culture, bringing the fringes to the center. Because yeah, like from like 2008 to 2011, that's when I finally started reading more books that academically and formally sort of defined and gave historical context for fascism, but also placed it in the United States, you know, in a Christian nationalist fund.
In
you know,
the United like, States? In the home of freedom, Nate?
And so this is the kind of stuff where like it is laid out as well as hopefully we know it is now, but it was the kind of thing that actually made me increasingly feel like I was becoming a wingnut in 2008 to 2010 just by absorbing this information, seeing it outside my window and trying to do something with it. So that was one of those moments where it was very bitterly vindicating to find that my work was actually doing what it set out to do.
Kind of prophetic in a very gloomy way.
Indeed. Yeah, like my kind of like viral webcomic about face that's in Save It For Later. Initially, as I was doing it, like that was also
every now and then that'll pop, like somebody will reshare that again and I'll read it and I'll just go, oh, like, yeah, chilling.
Yeah. At the time, like when I made it, like when I was assembling my observations and researching and when I drew it in 2018, I was working on Save It For Later as a separate book, and About Face was not yet seen by myself to be folded into it. Like it's now the central chapter of Save It For Later, but I was envisioning it as a natural kind of follow-up, a nonfiction follow-up to Any Empire. And like I was doing
to
loop it back to that. But I was also trying to keep it as short and sweet as I could. And yeah, it's just really wild that, you know, I guess it's not unexpected, but also chilling that because of the necessity of spreading that information, that's my most read comic ever. It's more read than March.
Wow. About
Face? Like, simply going by clicks.
Sure.
So take that with a grain of salt. But it's wild that it found a home way, way outside of comics.
Well, I would imagine that, 2018, it would be popular. But then in 2020 on, I'm sure that it has garnered up, unfortunately, quite the number of clicks and eyeballs.
You bet.
So we're talking about, before we go forward with some of your work, we're talking about like the power of art and fiction to shine light on these things. I'd love to hear from you. I know you've talked about it in other mediums before, but for our audience, I'd love to hear you talk about what was the role of both X-Men comics and punk rock music in kind of like helping you form your, like helping you develop social awareness.
You bet. They really arrived as a 1-2 punch for me. So I was born in 1978. I was aware of X-Men,
which set you up for like in real time having an incredible comic book reading experience.
Oh, without a doubt. So yeah, like I came of age during the boom and bust of early 90s speculation and pouches. Like, yeah, I'm a pouch child.
Well, I mean, even just those books in the 80s and 90s, just being able to read them month to month, like that must have been so exciting.
Oh, it was. And even like in the 80s in Alabama, as like a G.I. Joe Transformers kid, starting around right before the mutant massacre in X-Men, so like 1986, that's when I started noticing every issue's cover of X-Men. And I felt like there was this undercurrent where I knew that it was going to suck me in someday. But I didn't start reading it X-Men until 1990. And yet the second I fell in with it, thanks to a couple of friends, I felt like I already knew the characters because I had been spending 4 years looking at these covers month by month. But that was also within like the same month. Started reading X-Men and got introduced to metal, but specifically like 80s thrash metal and speed metal. So this is like the era of the big four, like Metallica, Megadeth, Anthrax, Slayer. It was really like Megadeth, Rust in Peace, and all of Anthrax's music, like Cold War era thrash metal, not only with like its nuclear apocalyptic outlook, but in particular with Anthrax's, you know, like bold anti-racism. It's like seeing through the military-industrial complex, seeing through the farce of late Soviet Reagan era America dichotomies.
Yeah, nationalism, basically.
Yes, indeed. And also they were making songs about Judge Dredd and Stephen King books and possibly about X-Men Fall of the Mutants. But it was a wild time for me. And so like X-Men and thrash metal kind of got folded in together and became this really powerful lens by which my 12-year-old self was able to see racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, nationalism in the world around me through the lens of fiction, through superheroes, through mutants, but also through this kind of supercharged, you know, like heavy metal art infused auditory experience.
That's so interesting, thinking about how, like, when I was growing up, my parents let me, I mean, I grew up in a relatively conservative religious environment, but also my parents were people of the arts. So I got to get a lot more than many of my peers growing up in that world. And yeah, like, getting to have those stories helped me just as, I mean, and I also grew up on the lower side of the economic spectrum. A lot of stuff just kind of helped prime me just very providentially. And I'm so, like, thankful for it, for, like, as I got older going, like, oh yeah, like, comic books, music, like, life experience. Oh, like, the world is not, like, the nationalistic myths and the Christian nationalist ethno state dream. Like, when you come of age, you're like, oh yeah, it was very helpful in priming me for this. And it's interesting how, with your work now, March is taught in schools around the country now. You're getting to be part of, like, the, like, national storytellers, like, through, like, partnering with John Lewis. Like, you guys got, like, you have told, you have a chapter in the American storybook with March. Like, what in the world was that like?
At the time, as we were getting everything assembled, you know, John Lewis and Andrew had worked together for about 2 years before I came on board, working up a rough script for a single volume simply called March. Once we decided to work together, which was actually a very quick, very intuitive gut feeling that we worked well together
and
we wanted to do this together. So we just, after about 2 weeks, just jumped into it. I know that Andrew and John Lewis knew that March was going to be a big book. And about a year before the first book came out, that's when we decided to divide it up into a trilogy, mostly just to make it less stressful for Andrew and I, not actually thinking about how, like, by dividing it up into a trilogy, not only could it grow organically as we discuss it while we make it, but the density, maturity of the reading experience actually gave it a, well, I'll go ahead and use the Harry Potter effect, because the term still has meaning that we understand.
Sure.
But, like, the Harry Potter effect worked in that, you know, like, I was even able to read, you know, March Book One with my kids when they were 4 or 5, you know, but kids who were in fourth grade with bold teachers were able to absorb that in a way that, you know, March Book Three is typically more for, like, older high school, college students, adults. All these ways in which March was able to really spread its wings and radically increase our ambitions and scope and scale of spreading this history were, I think those were these moments where we're like, we look back and we're like, yeah, we just really want to take the pressure off. But that's really what allowed March to do its thing. At the time, though, like, I knew March would be bigger than any other book I'd worked on at the time, but I did not have any sense of that potential scope or scale for the book, or what John Lewis's and Andrew's ambition was, the way that they saw it as a vision. Like, the fact that John Lewis really did see it as his, you know, in retrospect, his last great big work in terms of a contribution to society, to the legacy of his own peers and fellow freedom fighters and younger generations. I feel like they brought a lot of that longer reach and vision, and I grew into it once I realized that I was now stepping through a threshold that would require a lot more foresight and more responsibility and more accountability. So a lot of it was just, like, running in real time to recognize, like, what we were dealing with as it was snowballing and changing and growing.
Book one, you can give that one to just about anybody. Book two is a little bit longer, a little bit more nuanced. And then book three, like you said, that's for older. But I mean, it's got to be incredible, like, to see that kind of grow in real time. That just had to have been such a surreal experience. Like, you go from going, like, okay, like, I get to work with Senator John Lewis, like, this book could have an impact. But then, like, you're winning Eisner Awards, you're winning Humanitarian Awards, the Coretta Scott King Award, stuff like that, and going, like, oh, this is taught in schools. Like, this is a real thing. This is going to affect, this is going to, like, form generations of people. And, like, that's a dream as an artist, but, like, I'm sure that also has a little bit of pressure day in and day out too, as you're trying to what to leave in, like what to put in, what to leave out. What was that journey like?
In general, I found that that itself wasn't actually too stressful or intimidating. Most of the stress simply came from the more practical considerations along the way. Like, especially once the second March book was about halfway done, that's sort of where we crossed the threshold where we were, I was doing just maximum output while now traveling together as a team every week or every other week throughout the country for like 5 years straight and trying to combine that with parental and family responsibilities, et cetera. But in terms of like, a lot of it was really strictly positive in terms of that shift, certain doors kind of opening, but just really seeing the embrace of this work we had done, which was from the start envisioned as a comic. I'd say that wouldn't have been nearly as positive of an experience, except that John Lewis himself could see a mile away how many interviewers, people who were curious about March, but were interested in only using it as a way to talk to him, to ask him questions, to make it John Lewis focused. And he actively, at every single turn, took the care to redirect questions toward Andrew and I, to talk of, I mean, he would obviously, and should, he spoke about his experiences, his lived experiences at length, but was trying to fold it into this work that we did together. And I appreciate that he was an art collector and an art lover. He loved music. And so he spent his life being interested in and fascinated by, you know, creative people.
Right.
It was kind of wild, but also just the way it should be. The fact that he was actively taking the stand to remind people that we are here to talk about this work that we did together, which is being brought into the world of the 2010s, which was increasingly becoming more about our present moment than it was about the subject matter of the books themselves. We were just really fortunate. I was just talking with our beloved editor, Lee, yesterday about feeling so fortunate in that sweet spot during March, in which all the engines were clicking and we had this sense of like vision and mandate, but also we were on the cusp of, you know, this like wildly chaotic, foreboding shift in power occurring in the United States. And it was just really wild to be able to use the privilege of that attention and that momentum to be able to make some kind of a measurable change in American culture.
And since I've got you here, let me bounce a quick fact check off you. I don't know if this is apocryphal or not. I think I read or heard somewhere that somewhere the germ of the idea to make it a comic was that Dr. King at some point in some of his work, they were distributing little comics about civil rights. Is that true somewhere in there? Yeah.
So in a nutshell, that is all true. The origin story of March, is that Andrew, who had started as a staffer with...
And say his last name, Aiden?
Aiden.
Aiden. Andrew Aiden. He and John Lewis worked on writing the script, yes?
Yes. So Andrew wrote the script to March. They are both co-writers, but because John Lewis is a lifelong oral storyteller, besides also living the experience, they had a very atypical, very intensive co-writing experience together, which led to Andrew actually writing the script and doing untold thousands of hours of supplemental research and actually building up the narrative structure that guides the whole trilogy. Yeah, but he was a staffer starting in 06 or 07 with Congressman Lewis, and basically was gently getting made fun of one day for being a comic book nerd in the office.
It's relatable.
Yeah, this is like summer 2008 or something. And basically John Lewis stuck up for the nerd and was like, don't make fun of him. There was a comic book during the movement when I was a teenager. It was very influential. And Andrew was like, well, thanks, Congressman, but also what is this comic? And at the time, this had fallen into total kind of obscurity. It was a 1957 book about the Montgomery bus boycotts, called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story that was published by the Fellowship of Reconciliation. It was, 10 cents, 16 pages. And it itself has this fascinating history. But John Lewis was like, as a teenager, when I moved to Nashville and was being trained and taught by Jim Lawson about the principles and the discipline and philosophy of nonviolence, and as we were preparing for the beginning of the sit-in movement, this comic book was one of our primers. It was like a little Bible of civil disobedience and nonviolent resistance. And the book itself is really nicely made. It has like all the hallmarks of a classic, like mid-50s house style, but really, really beautifully made, very efficient, and complex enough for just being 14 pages of story. Anyway, like Andrew went home that night. It existed very recently digitized. Like
only I was going to ask, I'll put that in the show notes if that's widely available.
Yeah. And I think it was like crmvets.org was at the time the only place that actually had a digitized PDF. Top Shelf has gone since then to keep it in print.
Excellent.
Like as a physical object. But basically, Andrew just like could not give up on this idea that a comic had this wild history. He wound up doing his graduate thesis on the history of this comic and its impact on movements throughout the world. But basically, he was like, Congressman, I have an idea, like how to revitalize the history of the movement, get young people involved.
So you say a comic was influential. I think I may have something here for you.
Indeed. He was like, where's the comic about your life and your experiences as a young person in the movement? And he just basically, as Andrew will admit, he wore down John Lewis after a few months. And he's like, okay, we'll do it, but you got to write it with me.
And we are very grateful that he wore him down.
Likewise.
The main impetus for me reaching out to you was going back. I think I had read some of it when it came out, but when Save It for Later came out, I don't think I realized that it wasn't like narrative exactly. So I don't know if I finished it, but something recently triggered me to go check it back out. And then I was reading it, and that's what made me want to talk to you. And I'd love to have some time. I knew this conversation would go quickly. I want to talk about that. But one of the things you just said about John Lewis, I would love to hear your take, or just what are your thoughts on, especially as somebody who was raised in the South, looking at John Lewis and his life and how. So you said that comic was kind of like a big part of his training and framing for like the nonviolence, fighting for civil rights, like Dr. King, John Lewis, a host of other people, very much fueled by their faith in their work. And then on the other spectrum, you have people ostensibly, perhaps because of how they interpret their faith, being in diametric opposition. Like how do you reconcile that or view that, or your time with him being a seeming like he seems like a very wonderful man every time I heard him speak, reading the book. Like what was his take on it? What was your take? Like how did you what were those conversations like?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in general, he had spent his entire life having to deal with, white Christians who utilized their interpretation of faith to oppress their neighbors and to oppress, so many people around them. This was not, this was not something that was an emergence during the 21st century.
Certainly it's not a new thing. Yeah.
Andrew would always put this in Battlestar Galactica terms. This has all happened before. This will all happen again.
Yeah.
That's
John Solomon. Lewis, there's nothing new under the sun. Yeah, exactly.
John Lewis would always sort of bring back, be like, I've seen this before. We've managed to like slog through this. We've managed to like move forward as a society. We will not be going back. But he would like always be very plain that none of this on its face was particularly unexpected or shocking. However, increasingly towards the end of his life, he would be a little more candid in terms of like dysfunction in Congress being actually worse than he had ever seen it in his life. In terms of the return of blatant kind of like violent, terroristic, threatening and fascist undertones or overtones to mainstream political rhetoric, reminding him much more of his youth in the 50s and 60s in the American South. And so like it was just a, you know, it was very valuable to be able to center my perspective throughout the 2010s and moving through the 2020s through his and his generation's perspective as Black Southerners and as people of faith who were transformed by their faith into action. But also, so for me, so much of March and so much of Save It for Later is about intergenerational reckoning. And for that, much of my fiction is too. But
that's true, which is why I think it has so much value. And I'm so happy to be talking to you.
You bet. Well, thank you. Like being raised by, you know, like fairly cool, fairly concerned, moderate, liberal, white baby boomer Southerners. It's important to recognize that, you know, that, I mean, this actually ties all the way into Lies My Teacher Told Me, recognizing that there's an intergenerational block on reckoning with so much of the sense of continuity for me as a child in the 80s between being taught basic stuff about the civil rights movement in towns where I lived, places I could see, places I had visited, hearing my parents' own experiences, but always sort of having a caveat, a little bit of an obstacle that was like, oh, right, but this is not that. That was another time. Don't try to connect the present day with the past, which actually would be like 15 or 20 years in the past.
Yeah, that was a very like stark point of Save It for Later when you're like, yeah, some of this other stuff that I worked on, like this real history, that was 20 years ago. You had a scene where you drive by like a public cross-burning Klan rally and your parents kind of age appropriately give you a little bit, and then you reflect back on it and go, oh yeah, 20 years prior, these are the same people. Exact same like human beings doing what they did in the 60s, now doing this in the 80s.
Yeah, literally the same people involved in attacking the Freedom Riders bus outside of Anniston, Alabama in 1961. I have concluded that it is overwhelmingly likely that at least one of those people was at the Klan circle that I saw in the same town in 1983. And yeah, it's like, you know, I'm 45 now. And so it really is wild to be like, oh yeah, if I take myself back to 2004, I can reach back and just touch that. That seems like that's last month. Increasingly that kind of like telescoping and condensing of time, you know, it's a very natural thing, but I think it's an incredibly valuable thing as far as demythologizing the abstract, untouchable nature of past events, especially as we are reaping the most bitter fruits of that past.
And we've had several pastors, authors, activists engaged in social justice talk about these things. And we've talked about this multiple times where it's like people think of Dr. King and Malcolm X as like these historic figures. And like, no, there's videos on YouTube of like full speeches and lectures. Like these men did not live 100 years ago. Like there are people alive. Like John Lewis passed. He was not extremely old. He passed 4 years ago and he was contemporaries with these people. There are people who like are alive today who saw these things firsthand. And like, we like to think of, oh, that bad stuff. That was a long time ago, which is why, I mean, an early plug for your upcoming book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, like the American myth is something that you see today, like the last probably 5 years, especially like people raging against, like, we need to tell the truth versus like whitewash it. Like, I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to see about it. Like, I don't want to be confronted with like just reality. And the fact of the matter is if we're going to move forward, which is to bring it back to Save It for Later, what I love so much about that is just the hope. And I'd love to hear specifically a lot of our audience, like I'm in my mid 30s. A lot of our audience is like late 20s to the 30s, and forming our children in these things in age appropriate ways is something that I think about a lot, but that we've talked about before on the show. your book brought me to tears a number of times, just trying to the stumbles and the fumbles and the successes, like the part where I think it was probably your older daughter talked about like standing up in class, like for the kids who can't do it for themselves as easily. Like that's what we want. But like, what have you learned in a nutshell? Like we don't want to inundate, like our brains are kind of broken with social media and these like 10 second things that are like, we have too much information. We can't shoulder the entire, like all the atrocities in the world. We don't want to be ignorant to it, but like we're not responsible for fixing everything, but we want to be aware and making progress wherever we can. So what are some bullet point thoughts as far as raising the next generation of resistors and like people who are loving their neighbor and making the world a better place?
Well, yeah. I mean, importantly, this really is where, you know, it's been encouraging now to be old enough that I'm like technically middle-aged. but, in, you know, like over this past decade to recognize as a dad that like, oh, there are already things. And by already, I mean like 6 or 7 years ago, there are already things that I'm out of touch about or that I'm a dinosaur about. Yeah. And so even for a young kid, pointing out something that doesn't add up or being more idealistic than I, those were the moments where I felt it was really important for me to be like, oh, like one of the main takeaways here is like, no matter how cool you think you are, you have to, like, it's really, to me, it's about being vulnerable to being wrong or recognizing where you're out of touch and mostly just like, be ready to shut up, be ready to shut up and listen, even if it's a very young person who, like, we say this kind of stuff all the time, but it's actually true. They have a much more clear moral compass than we do. Sure. Because they're not bogged down by the intricacies of reality. But it's important to listen to that clarity to kind of recenter our values in terms of, I mean, even in the practical sense, what we want and need to spend energy on. That was a big thing. But also just the fact that, like, kids are going to ask questions. Kids are going to notice all this stuff, even if they have a hard time articulating it. So as adults of any age, whether or not you have kids, like if you have young people in your life, your responsibility is to be listening when a young person actually asks any of these questions. And it's okay to not know the best answer or a correct answer. This is actually another thing that goes back to any empire that I was trying to circle around. It's like in the subtext throughout the book, but it doesn't have voiceover narration, so it's not a very heavy-handed book, was the fact that people are afraid to say, I don't know, as a legitimate answer. Hmm. And I actually think that's the source of a lot of problems. Yeah. With people doubling down and people embracing increasingly like increasing echo spheres of ideology tied into information, is the inability to either hold, you know, two things that are contradictory as both being true, or the reluctance to say, I don't know the answer. And I think it's really important. And that's something that is underlined to me every single day as a parent.
Yeah, no, we've talked about that a ton on the show. Like, nuance is so important. And sometimes, understandably, people who cling to certainty do so much more damage, because you can't just be humble and say, oh, I never thought of that. Or, oh, I'm not quite sure how that works. But if you're like, no, I need like a dogmatic, like my identity and my security depends on me knowing the answers, then you kind of get to, I feel like, There are, in my view, a few extremely malicious, purely evil people out there fueling some awful things. But then you have a lot of maybe well-meaning, maybe ignorant, maybe lazy people who fall back on some of these securities. And they're like, oh yeah, like certainty is good. And like they end up fueling just horrors.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. That's part of the banality of evil. Like to use the phrase, it's built upon a falling back into a safe space, which is really a place of privilege, but it's a place that goes with the assumption that you won't be directly affected by the thing that has just troubled you. And so it's okay to just kind of go back into your corner. But then even backing up to the beginning of that, I think that for all like young adults, but this is especially acute coming from my world of like being really shaped by punk, growing up in and through it and having it still be, you know, a big part of my life, is that, you know, like nobody's more dogmatic and idealistic than like a 22-year-old.
Exactly. Yeah. Like an 18-year-old, 20-year-old, like punk singer. Sure. Yeah.
And you know, like there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, because part of it is this dynamic tension amongst you and your friends and the rest of the community, recognizing and knowing that that's the case and trying to counteract it, but you're also like policing each other and all this. So like, yeah, a lot,
which is like 100-fold now with social media.
Oh, without a doubt, man. I'm so glad I'm not a young adult during this era. But like with Fall Through, which is fiction and has like, you know, there's bootleg magic and all this stuff, it still revolves around that tension of being pulled along by the ideals, which like really fuel punk and particularly my generation of hardcore punk. But then people's individual lives separately kind of like reaching their own kind of center, their own pulls of gravity that eventually require a different level of attention. That sort of breaking up of a band as a result of real life pulling away at the fabric of the ideals that might have held a group or a band or a set of friends together. But I mean, yes, so much of like the actual drama as well as the melodrama within punk, culturally speaking, has to do with that dynamic tension involving ideals. And so much of it really is just basically growing up. How are we going to be adults in the world? You know, that's really all it is. It's just wrapped up in a sense of self-righteousness because we figured out how to do a whole bunch of stuff ourselves, which is amazing. But part of the problem is being like, yeah, but that's not even necessarily that unique. Like, it's awesome that it exists in this way in this community. But like, when I became less involved with punk as a subculture and more involved with comics,
people like, care about stuff here too. Weird. Yeah, I thought I was like, the only one.
I was like, the DIY ethic is the same. Yeah, you know, like social and political concerns are the same. The way that this microcosm as an industry finds a balance as a creative community and as a group of friends, it's all the same stuff. And it was really meaningful in my life in a huge sense to kind of knock down that exceptionalism from punk, which is when you really level up. Aging through punk is getting rid of the exceptionalism.
That is good. And I mean, across the board, I think that is healthy and something that we should strive for.
Without a doubt.
One other thing that I was really wanting to ask you about. So in Save It For Later, there's a scene, seems probably directly real from experience, where you and your daughter start watching the Wonder Woman show. And then the next day when she wants to play like good guys and bad guys, she's playing bad guys. And she drew a swastika on her arm. And then you're like, okay, you had to have the conversation about symbols and like good guys and bad guys, like kids understand that. And when they want to play, how they engage with that. And then combine that scene with later, you had a scene talking about, hey, like some of us may want to distance ourselves from people who are problematic or like in the banality of evil. But there's a scene where like you talking with one of your neighbors somewhere and you made incremental progress.
Oh, right.
So yeah. Talk to me about the tension between, there are some things that are just bad. That is categorically bad. If you see somebody engaging this, like that is categorically bad. And also like there's hope, like there's redemption for people. And we want to engage with ideas to hopefully bring some of these folks into the light. Like just the tension there, both yourself as a parent, but also a lot of our audience is also parents trying to raise children. Like we want to be clear, like evil is evil and we don't want any part of it. And these people engaged in it, like they shouldn't be, but also they are human and there is hope for them too. Like, talk to me about that dichotomy.
Yeah, for me, a lot of this is my own intergenerational reckoning, you know, with Southern white baby boomer parents, where they're, you know, as part of the lost cause myth, which, you know, really extends all the way to the present day, with my parents' generation being raised through that kind of lost cause mythology. And a lot of it had to do with fundamentally seeing historically, with my parents' generation and before, seeing a lack of any real ideological division between the North and the South in terms of leading into and through and after the Civil War. And actually, in Lies My Teacher Told Me, James Lewin lays out very clearly the historical precedent by which this was approached as a theory which allowed, in the 1870s and 1880s, allowed white supremacy to reassert its hold, to reunite America by reoppressing a large swath of people. And the myth is so powerful that it's really heavily embedded, the notion that your racist white neighbor may be mighty racist, but they're fundamentally either like, in, you know, like this came out in different ways for me, even outside of the South, this notion that, for example, like you see, like, and this is prior to the modern post 2007 era, but this notion that like you see young, you know, you see like young, like Nazi skinheads, that you should primarily approach them in your head in good faith, that they're probably confused, mixed up, they got sorted into something wrong. I received a great wake-up call on my first European tour with my band back in 2002, and we had 3 days of dealing with actual German Nazis. It's a long, wild story, but so much of it had to do in each of these three stops, kind of like waiting and having our German hosts or our driver or our tour manager or somebody just kind of like seeing what their approach was to any situation and kind of navigating that and balancing it with this rapidly crumbling internalized kind of Generation X kid approach that like, yes, so these a-holes also are probably fundamentally just like mixed up, misunderstood or whatever. And then it would take out like our driver, who was a little person and was also queer, and very immediately was seeing like the danger signs happening in certain venues we were in. And as we were trying to deliver these platitudes, once we did make it out of there and we were back on the road, you know, she would stop us and be like, You can say that kind of stuff all you want with your mixed up American teens, but she's like, this is Germany and these are Nazis. And that was the end of the discussion. And that was something that would really like change my life, and recognizing that like there's something about the eternal obsession with reconciliation, the obsession with redemption narratives, especially for racist, violent white Americans, that allowed the 2010s to happen, which allowed us to live here at the precipice.
Yeah, which allowed 2016 and 2020 to happen. Yeah.
And so like, I think as a parent, my main takeaway from that is recognizing that yes, there are very clear dichotomous lines that you can take. And more or less what I decided to take by 2015 with my kids, which, and I outline this and save it for later, but simply like for very young kids was recognizing that like the Confederate flag and the swastika, like that these are the bad flags.
These are the bad ones.
That do not have any place in society. And you can basically write out people entirely who fly these. And then I had to, you know, because we live in a suburban neighborhood with a lot of people who are not, who just, they're just not in touch. They don't think deeply about stuff, or they buy into a lot of the consumer culture, which gives us these kind of authoritarian, you know, paramilitary.
Which is insane. Like, you talk about growing up in the 80s with comics, like, and I mean, barring what some of his output has become in the last decade or so, but like, in 2016 to 2020 and beyond, like almost not a week goes by without me going like, we're living like in a Frank Miller comic in the 80s, like right now. Like especially when we had the last guy who was the president and he'd say the things he'd say. And you got like the gross consumerism, you got the fascism, you got it mixed with religion. And I'm like, all these artists 20 years ago, 30 years ago, this is what we're like, we're in RoboCop. Like this is what we are.
I think about RoboCop constantly because of the aesthetics of the movie. Like it's 1987, you know, but the fact that it's impossible now for someone who wasn't like alive and kicking at the time to view it
like a pre-internet person.
The shocking lens watching RoboCop as like a 9 or 10 year old and actually seeing militarized police with assault rifles and, you know, like submachine guns, but also full body armor, armored, like monochrome cars. All of this stuff is our reality. Typically, I'll watch part of RoboCop anytime it comes on TV because it's so fascinating to me how quaint and like standard fare it looks in terms of just being kind of a B movie when I watch it now. And yet it was intended and crafted as this shocking dystopian hellscape that was almost unimaginable in 1987.
Oh, yeah.
And yet was accurately, just like Starship Troopers, was accurately pointing towards the path in which it was entirely normalized.
And 35 years later, 30 years later, yeah, this is it.
So, yeah, but one of the main things I impart to my kids is that is basically there are all kinds of people everywhere, and we don't have time to be like, it's great to give to, like, especially as we know people and to exhibit empathy and to, you know, to be willing to give people a chance if they show that they have a capacity to actually learn and grow. But we no longer have a responsibility to preemptively extend that gesture of good faith for people who by now we have very clear signs are not interested in that kind of growth. And it's the kind of thing where I feel like I'm going insane, that I feel like a lot of people have actually forgotten everything from the last 10 years.
It's preposterous.
Yes.
Having conversations with some people, you're like, where have you been?
Yeah.
Like, and we all laughed. I don't even know how many years ago when somebody said like alternative facts, but like, that was also tragically prophetic. Like you have people who are on their devices, listening to their podcasts or news feeds or what have you, literally living in like a parallel world.
And to me now, it's like, it's very important when you're dealing with young people, just to actually be courageous enough and be like, think about it first so that you actually know how you stand on this. But, you know, like it's okay to tell your kid, like that somebody's beyond redemption, or like, just don't interact with them. That person is there is no hope for them. And to recognize that these are people who will in a heartbeat do you ill, and will allow ill acts to happen to you. And there's absolutely nothing radical or conspiracy minded about that. For anyone who's paid any attention and remembered anything over the past 10 years. And to me, that's what's so insane, is people want to pretend like that's not the main takeaway from the last 10 years, is there are people who are actively, there's a large amount of people, of white Americans, who are actively okay with a fascist dictatorship.
Which is insane.
Yes.
Which back when 2011, when you're like, things are crazy, you were like barely suggesting it. But now it's literally like, that's what we want, like loud and proud. Yes, and you're
exactly.
Like,
so like, what? Just trust what you've learned, you know, like that's the main thing, is like, question yourself, you know, like reread some things, you know, read the news, but trust the things that you know and keep them. Like Sarah Kendzior, the writer, really like, wrote a really transformative thing in November 2016. It's like, you know, we're entering dark times. Here's how to be your own light. And one of her main points in that iconic piece was that, you know, like very quickly you'll arrive at a point, especially in an authoritarian power grab or an authoritarian state, in which you're going to be called on to doubt your own memories and experiences as a way of doubting your own core values and your own sense of meaning in life and lines you won't cross. You'll be asked to cross those lines. And the most important thing, especially, you know, during her writing, especially in those early years, she would always be like, believe it or not, this is, we're going to look back in 1 year and all this will seem quaint. So she'll be like, during these relatively quaint times, take the time to kind of recognize what you value, certain lines that you would be willing to cross, certain lines that you absolutely can't cross or won't cross, and make sure you remember all of these lines that you have set for yourself, because you will be called on to go against your core values. And so that's something I've always tried to recenter myself, is recognizing where those limits are for me.
No, that's good. And then coupled with the nonviolent approach, because it's very easy to get pulled into, like, especially when we're talking about people being very pro fascist dictatorships, like out and about in public, it's very easy for things to escalate. But yeah, no, it's the day in and day out.
What they want is violence. And so, yeah, like, this is where, like, we always are very, like, pro self-defense with our kids, and we've raised our kids that way. But at the same time, it's important to always underline that, particularly in terms of, like, you know, the equivalent of any kind of shock troop or brown shirt, any boogaloers or whatever, what they want is an acceleration of violence. And so
that they can live out their violent fantasies.
Right. It's a part of the structure of this fascist plan. And so it's very important to, whether it's picking your battles or whether it's like kind of rationalizing what the outcome is going to be of anything you do, very infrequently is escalation to violence going to be something that's worth it. For me, the main exception is that I'm a really strong supporter of direct anti-fascist action. And so, like, for me, I think, like, supporting Antifa activism is really crucial, especially when you see how quickly white supremacists and these fascists fold when they are directly confronted by physical resistance in the streets. I think it's really important that people recognize that it is a fallacy, this, like, outdated idea that if you ignore fascists, that they will parade down an empty street and they won't get attention and they'll go away. It's all attention, no matter what it is. So we now have an obligation, like, you have to assess your personal level of risk and what you're willing and able and capable of doing. But it's important that if you're able to physically show up to resist against these forces, that you do it.
Yeah, because I mean, I've seen it here in small amounts, but you see it on the news. I've seen friends who live in different cities and areas where there's more. It's like, no, these people are on our streets right now, just parading,
yes,
and maybe one or two people are going up to them, and that's very important.
And that's the, like, recognizing that none of this is like an all or nothing binary thing. It's like, if you don't have it in you to do martial arts training and get body armor and actually get fighting, that's okay. It's equally important that you show up as a, you know, in a defensive capacity to keep other more vulnerable people safe, even recognizing that you may take a hit. And even beyond that, it's important to continue showing up to be one of those people who might even need some defending. But this is where, like, everyone has a role to play, and it only does fascists good to put it in this dichotomy of, like, the second one person becomes violent, we're no better than them. That's not true.
Well, hey, Nate, I've really appreciated this. I've appreciated your work for a long time. I'm very excited for my copy of Fall Through to come through here at the library, but also Lies My Teacher Told Me, I'm very excited to check that out as well. I'll be putting links for all of that in the show notes. And now it's time for Substance shout outs. I would love to hear the workspace for folks looking at the video, supporters, what have you. You've got a lot of media back there. What are you reading? What are you listening to? What are you watching that has been either just a nice relief from the hellscape, or that has challenged you, or that you found particularly moving that you'd like to put on people's radar?
As far as what I've been reading, in the last year and a half or 2 years, I've fallen way, way, way back into X-Men after 25 years away. So yeah, like I probably read 15,000 pages of X-Men since then. It's definitely still my home planet. Also very interesting and valuable books. I've recently started reading this book, Holy Food, which is basically a history of the ways in which religious movements in America, both super mainstream and super cult movements, have influenced American culture through food, and basically meaning like through religious laws, through cult rules, through the practical considerations of being in a certain time and place, the way that changed the way certain groups of people ate in a faith-based way. Fascinating book.
Interesting.
Also recently by, I think, Matthew Delmont, read Half American, a fantastic book that is centered around the experiences of Black Americans who participated on the front lines and in the war industry in World War II, and how this set the stage for the civil rights movement, but also the outsized white supremacist backlash they experienced in the United States and throughout the armed forces, and how that transformed their own experience of what, anti-fascist work in Europe in World War II meant when coming back home to a white supremacist framework in America. An absolutely fascinating book. And having read a ton of civil rights history books in the last 15 years, 95% of the information I didn't know about. Musically, I've been listening to a lot of just like ambient electronic and vaporwave stuff while working on my books. So like the number one musician I listen to right now is OK Akumi. I think he's a dude from Salt Lake City. And he has one of my favorite albums of all time. It's called Alpine Sequences. But also Hammered Hulls, which is like, you know, fantastic kind of hardcore punk band from the Washington, D.C. area.
Sounds like it. I'm not familiar, but that sounds like that kind of band.
Have just really been a breath of life into me. And I guess the only real shout out I'll give on for TV watching is that my life is saved every time there's a new season of Love on the Spectrum.
Okay.
Which is basically like there's an Australian version and an American version, but it's essentially a dating reality show that's very well made, that is strictly folks on the autism spectrum navigating, you know, the complex realities of dating and human connection. And it's just really like such a fantastic dose of just like seeing how well people can listen to and read each other and exhibit empathy and like be willing to take risks and you know, go through change. So those are my recommendations.
I hear that Love, I haven't pressed play yet, but I hear Love on the Spectrum is just incredibly just wholesome and joyful and just a nice little balm in these times.
It is. It's so helpful.
Well, Nate, thank you for your time. Thank you for your work all these years, and really appreciated having you.
Happy to be here, Philip. Thanks for having me.
So there you have it. That was my conversation with Nate Powell. Had such a great time talking with him. Check out his work, purchase it wherever you buy books. You can also go on his website for some of them, not marked up at all. Some are only very slightly marked up. You can buy all of his books signed. I'll be sure to include a link for that in the show notes. And be sure to keep an eye on the social media for some potential giveaways there as well for Nate's work. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it, two best ways to support the show are to give us a rating and review. If you're on Spotify, hit that 5-star button. If you're on iTunes, we ask that you take 30 to 60 seconds. Give us a 5-star rating and write a sentence or two about what you like. It helps other people find the show. And if you want to be a part of the show and what we're doing, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/thesubstancepod, where for as little as $3 a month, you can join the team. You can have a say in future shows. You get early and exclusive video content of the show. And you can just, and we are brainstorming currently about other incentives as well. So you can find that there. Or if monthly support isn't your bag and you'd still like to, hey, I want to give them $5, $10, $20, whatever. Yeah, $2. You can do that on Cash App at $TheSubstancePod. Every little bit helps. And as we make our plans for the year and look at things we want to do, that is always a helpful thing. So those are the two ways to financially support the show. And we appreciate every single person that does that. Next on The Substance, very excited to announce that we'll be going back to substantive cinema, covering the classic Western, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Actually, for you patrons, got the brand new re-release of the Paramount Blu-ray, and it rocks. Show you here on the video. I'm going to be joined by Elliot Cohen from the Boutique Blu-ray YouTube channel. He's somebody I found during COVID. I was looking for videos on the Criterion Collection. Actually, I think it was Criterion Collection Halls, and he had some really good videos. And so I've been watching him for a few years now. And we've been going back and forth for the last few months talking about, hey, like, what would be a good movie? So we decided on this. We already have had that conversation. It's fantastic. And if you're in the US, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance should be streaming on Prime, or you can get the Blu-ray. It's a great movie. Elliot was fantastic to talk to. So that'll be coming up next time on the show. So if you want to watch ahead, that's where you can do it. And I've been your host, Philip Marinello, and we hope to see you back next time on The Substance. I thought it was cool. I did know this a little bit about you, but on your initial Google page, it says comic book artist and musician. So the musician is still on your tagline.
Still floating around there. It's still true.
Are you actively making music still?
No, but last year, half of my main band, Sukunen Squad, half of our members reunited to play an 8-minute set covering another beloved Little Rock band's songs. So I did play bass and yell for a solid 8 minutes. For the first time since 2010, and that ruled.
There you go. That's probably like a nice amount of time to dip your toe back into that too.
It was perfect. Yeah, and I practiced for like 8 months to play for the 8 minutes.
There you go. I'm a little bit younger than you, but I'm all the things that I used to do when I was like 20, I'm feeling it now, and I'm like, I can only do some of these things for so long.
it's really wild what you discover, whether it's physically or psychologically, or just time and priority.
Yeah, it's energy and prior commitments.
Yeah, and you're like, well, that's just not even a possibility.